I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. It's crunch time for high school seniors. The deadline for college applications is coming up soon. Elite schools like Harvard University will receive more than 42,000 pitches for admission. Only about 1,600 will succeed. A group of Asian American students who applied but didn't get into Harvard has sued the university, claiming systematic discrimination. The trial provided some insight into the mysterious admissions process at Harvard, and it has engendered debate about affirmative action and the best way to achieve diversity on college campuses. My guests are Aaron Mack of Slate Magazine, Brenda Shum of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and Professor Julie J. Park of the University of Maryland. Should race matter when you apply to college? That's next on Midday, right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us today. This is the time of year when high school students around the country are putting the finishing touches on their college applications. Today on Midday, we're going to take a look at the vagaries of the college admissions process, particularly efforts by colleges to achieve racially balanced classes as they sift through thousands of applications. In a case in federal district court in Boston, Harvard University has been sued by a group of Asian American students who were denied admission to the elite Ivy League school. The students are supported in their case by the Trump administration Justice Department. They have been organized by a conservative activist named Edward Blum, who has been involved in several other high-profile affirmative action cases, as well as the 2013 Supreme Court ruling that limited the scope of the Voting Rights Act. Blum is the president of Students for Fair Admissions, and this case has drawn national attention and no shortage of controversy among Asian Americans and others. Should admissions decisions by colleges be made without considering race? Are Asian American students, who are often referred to as the model minority, at a disadvantage when they apply to college? If colleges and universities value diversity, what is the best way to put together a racially diverse group of students? Do college admissions have to be a zero-sum game for people of color? My guests are Aaron Mack. He's a reporter for Slate who's on the line from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Aaron. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Julie J. Park is on the faculty of the University of Maryland and the author of Race on Campus, Debunking Myths with Data. She joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Hi, Julie.
Hi, glad to be here.
And Brenda Shum is with us as well. She's the director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and she joins us on the phone from Little Rock, Arkansas. Brenda, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, you can join our conversation as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. You want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So Aaron Mack, if I may, let me start with you. During this trial, it came to light, and your reporting indicates that for the past several decades, 30 years or so, Harvard University has had specific mechanisms in its policies that give white applicants an advantage over Asian Americans. So what are those mechanisms?
So these mechanisms are not at play in the lawsuit. The lawsuit deals with other issues in the admissions process, but these mechanisms are athletic recruitment, legacy admissions, the personal rating, the Z-list. These all seem to serve white applicants over Asian Americans, and it also disadvantages other people of color.
Talk a little bit about the personal interview. What do colleges mean when, or what kind of determinations do they make based on that?
So the personal rating is this hodgepodge of different factors. It includes personality qualities like effervescence or leadership or grit. It also includes where you come from, your essays, alumni interviews. And we know that Asian Americans get the lowest personal ratings of all the ethnic groups, and that Asian Americans' representation at Harvard are actually dragged down by these low personal ratings. We don't know a lot about how Harvard does personal ratings. They haven't released a lot of information on it. Not a lot has been studied in this area. And it really deserves more scrutiny because it certainly looks very suspicious.
And Brenda Shum, the Students for Fair Admissions, this organization that Edward Blum leads, basically makes the case that if you're race conscious in your decisions for college admissions, that's equivalent to racial profiling. And he says, you know, you wouldn't want the police to be doing racial profiling. You wouldn't want prosecutors to do racial profiling when they're selecting a jury. He says race and ethnicity should simply not be used to help or harm you at any time in life. What do you think of that perspective?
I think, first of all, it's important to note that Harvard's admissions program has been deemed constitutional and is fully compliant with what the Supreme Court has required in terms of the limited use of race in college admissions. We do understand that Ed Blum and the Students for Fair Admission are asserting that Harvard is engaged in inflicting an Asian penalty on Asian American applicants, and those arguments are almost exclusively dependent on some data analysis. And while statistical analysis and data is helpful and informative of questions related to differences in admit rates and potential explicit or implicit bias in college admissions, we believe that over the course of the three-week trial that essentially just ended in Boston, it is very apparent that the plaintiffs are making sort of two separate legal claims, one of intentional discrimination, but another really challenging affirmative action in the use of race in its holistic admissions process. And that is not the driver of any type of differential in admit rates for Asian American applicants.
And Brenda Shum, let me ask you to clarify for listeners, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, your relation to this case. Have you been involved in some tangential way in the case in Boston?
Absolutely. We have been directly involved in the litigation against both Harvard and the corresponding case that Ed Blum and SFFA have brought against the University of North Carolina, asserting very similar claims. But we represent a very diverse group of Harvard and UNC applicants, current students, and graduates, and they are defending the university's ability to use race as one of many factors in admissions decisions.
And we should remind listeners that SFFA is Students for Fair Admissions. That's the organization that's rounded up these Asian Americans to be part of this suit. And Julie Park, we've got there has been, you write about in your book about how this notion that Asian Americans needed 140 points higher scores on their SATs and whites over white students and 200 points higher than black students to get in to the top colleges. This is a meme. This is a thing that's gone viral on the internet. This has become perceived wisdom among people in the Asian American community, to be sure. What does your research show about the veracity of that claim?
Sure. Before I answer that, I should mention that I served as a consulting expert on the case on the side of Harvard, and so all views are my own. Really, yes, this 140 points soundbite has gone viral, both within the Asian American community and more broadly. But I think it really reflects a misconception and misinterpretation of research that was originally done by Thomas Espenshade of Princeton and Alexandra Walton Radford. It is true that Asian Americans, on average, have higher test scores, standardized test scores. And that shouldn't be a surprise because Asian Americans' participation in test prep, SAT prep type courses, is much higher than other groups. And so these higher test scores are not a surprise. They have these higher test scores, but that doesn't mean that they need them necessarily to get in, just because when you're at the level of highly selective institutions, there is no, oh, you get this test score, you're in. There's no required test score because, you know, there's so many different factors. And very easily, Harvard, a place like Harvard, could fill its class over and over again with students who have perfect test scores. But that's not what they're necessarily interested in. And so really, I think this 140 points, it reflects, you know, an average, right, when you're comparing groups. But the idea that it's a necessity or a requirement to get into these schools is really a misconception.
And Aaron Mack, what have the folks at Harvard said about their efforts to achieve what folks are calling racial balance among you know, entering freshman classes. Do they talk about a particular metric that they think is the right one to use? I mean, do you have an opinion about what the best way of achieving a balanced class is, assuming that everybody aspires to diversity on the campus and everybody aspires to having people from different ethnic, religious, and socioeconomic backgrounds as part of the mix in every class?
Yeah, so I think that Harvard's use of race in the admissions process is good. It does not use any quotas. There's no saying that black people or Asian people have to finish have to account for a certain percentage of the class. It really works as a tip. So it takes into account a bunch of different factors in a person's life, and race is one of those factors. So it's not a determinative thing. It's really just looking at the whole person. So I do think that their use of race is good. But there are many things that they do in their admissions process, like legacies, like athletic recruitment, that do disadvantage Asian Americans compared to white people.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that in a bit. But Brenda Shum, before I do that, do you have an opinion about the best way to achieve racial balance? I mean, people talk about informal quotas for people from different races in every class. The quotas themselves, I guess, are not legal. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And so first and foremost, I think it's important to understand that the U.S. Supreme Court has definitively determined that racial balancing and racial quotas of any type are unconstitutional. And the Harvard program, as was already mentioned, does not utilize race as an automatic plus or an automatic benefit. And I think that the data, as well as the analysis by both experts for SFFA, as well as for Harvard, consistently found that there are variations in the application and admit rates of all the different racial subgroups over the time period in which the data was analyzed. And so I think that there, during the course of the trial, it seemed that the trial step strategy, at least of SFFA, was to back away somewhat from their assertions of definitive racial balancing and really try to highlight their allegations that there is a disadvantage embedded in the personal rating score that was already discussed.
And Julie J. Park, you teach at College Park at the University of Maryland. Is there a distinction? What's the difference between racial balance and diversity? Is there a difference?
Sure, I think so. I would say that, yeah, racial balancing, I'm not even quite sure what that refers to. If that was a thing, actually, I don't think Harvard's doing a very good job of it. Then, you know, if we were really seeking equitable proportions, you probably have a lot more African-American, Latino, Native American students, and you actually don't have them. The numbers are still relatively low. So very much, you know, what does exist, I think, are efforts, right, to build a racially diverse class, and also ideally a socioeconomically diverse class, although that's one probably that elite colleges fall behind a little more. So at a place like University of Maryland and, you know, at the College Park campus, at least, I think that just refers to looking at the entirety of the student's application, you know, their achievements, their extracurriculars, their teacher recommendations, all of those things. You know, it can relate to where they, you know, their high school, the context of their high school and the educational opportunities they have. And then among all of that information and potentially much more, race, ethnicity can also be something that's considered, but it's never as the sole factor or even really, I think, the prominent factor. And so the ideal is, you know, to be able to hopefully have students of color represented at some level. But in terms of seeking some sort of magic number, I don't think there's really anything like that. It's definitely, you know, not a one-size-fits-all formula.
Yeah, that magic number is a subjective thing. I mean, for example, nationally, the African-American population is around 13%. Does that mean classes colleges and universities should be 13% African American? On the other hand, when you look at like Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, in 2016, Julie Park, you report in your book, African American enrollment was 2.5%. On the other hand, two-thirds of Americans don't go to college. right? So there's one third of the populace that goes to college. Does that change your calculation and your metric? We'll talk about that with our listeners and with our guests when we come back. Brenda Shum is the director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Aaron Mack is a reporter for Slate who has written about the Harvard court case. Julie J. Park is on the faculty of the University of Maryland and the author of Race on Campus, Debunking Myths with Data. We will have more on affirmative action and college admissions when we come back from this quick break. Our number here at Midday, if you want to be part of the conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And before we go to break, my conversation yesterday with Emmy Favilla, the former copy editor of BuzzFeed, elicited lots of emails and calls, many of which we weren't able to get onto the show. But after the show, I did hear from John McIntyre. He's the copy editor at the Baltimore Sun. And he made a comment about my objection to people beginning emails with the greeting, "I hope this email finds you well." So I objected because I thought it ungrammatical to have an email finding anything about anyone. And John wrote, "Well, as it happens, I hope this letter finds you in good health is a stereotypical and old-fashioned letter opening. Now, why anyone would adapt it to email, I can't imagine, but one sense of find, Merriam-Webster says, is to, quote, meet with a particular reception, which I think should cover that situation." So that is the word, according to John McIntyre. I'm grateful to John and to everybody who tuned in yesterday and today and to infinity and beyond. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Michael Curley. He's a lawyer and environmental finance expert who's written a thought-provoking new book about different ways to find the money to fund environmental projects that we all agree we need to safeguard the environment. The book is called Paying for Tomorrow, Maintaining Our Quality of Life. And Kara Ober, the editor and publisher of the journal Be More Art. She'll also join me to talk about the latest edition of that very interesting magazine, which launches its latest edition tomorrow. And plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Beetlejuice at the National Theater in Washington. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the recent federal lawsuit filed against Harvard University alleging racial discrimination against Asian American applicants. Does affirmative action penalize Asian American students who are high achievers academically? And is it time to consider ending race-conscious college admissions? My guests are Aaron Mack, who covers tech and politics for Slate Magazine. He covered the trial. Brenda Shum, the director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and Julie J. Park. She's an associate professor of education at the University of Maryland. You're welcome to be part of our conversation about college admissions, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. If you are a high school student, by the way, and you're listening to the show because you're skipping school, I promise I won't tell. We'd love to hear you. Again, the phone number, 410-662-8780. Brenda Shum, the New Yorker magazine published a piece by Jeannie Sook Gerson, who is on the faculty of Harvard Law School and an alum of the Harvard Law School. And she says that there are serious questions about the future of affirmative action. The Trump administration, of course, has made it clear that its preference for race-blind admission policies, which they rescinded in July, the Obama administration's guidance to universities and colleges to use race-conscious affirmative action. In a legal sense, what's your take on the future of affirmative action in the admissions process given the current administration?
I would agree with the assessment that affirmative action in higher education admissions is under direct attack within this administration. As you already mentioned, the Obama administration's guidance on the voluntary use of race, both at the K-12 level as well as in higher ed admissions in order to promote more diverse and integrated learning environments, was pulled by this administration. And then in addition to eliminating the federal guidance that really explained to college administrators how to think about race in a constitutional way when they were making admissions, when they're making admissions decisions. The Department of Justice, as you already mentioned, filed a statement of interest in the Harvard litigation, essentially objecting to Harvard's motion for summary judgment and really adopting almost wholesale a lot of the asserted facts that SFFA had made in some of their legal filings. But I do think that the law is quite clear. And over 30 years of Supreme Court precedent have made it have really established that the limited and narrowly tailored use of race in college admissions to promote some of the essential educational benefits of diversity that are really at the core of a college or university's learning and teaching mission, that is a constitutionally permissible objective. And I think that what's really important to understand is that this trial was very helpful in trying to help the public understand the Harvard admissions process. And one of the things we had access to by virtue of this litigation are the complete admission files that Harvard maintains for some of our student clients. And you can see from those files not just what the students submitted in terms of their application, but also some of the highlights and important points that the Harvard admissions officers identified as part of those admission or application packets. And when you take a look at those records, it is very apparent that the use of race in the Harvard's admissions process is very nuanced. It does not apply a penalty to Asian American applicants. And as a matter of fact, we believe that it was really instrumental in highlighting for us and for the court the fact that Harvard understands the concept of diversity within diversity. So even within a single racial group or ethnic group, they really attempted to identify the strengths and contributions that individual applicants might make to the Harvard campus and community by virtue of their specific racial and ethnic background.
And Aaron Mack, would you agree with Brenda Shum's assessment of what came out at the trial? I mean, there are a lot of folks who say that the SFFA plan, this is Students for Fair Admissions, amounts to a zero-sum game for communities of color. So any Asian American who doesn't get in maybe makes a place for an African American student or an Hispanic student. Did they talk about that much?
Yeah, so the SSFA's aims to end affirmative action and to frame this as a zero-sum game are very destructive. This lawsuit would be catastrophic for diversity on campuses if it reaches the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court bans affirmative action. That being said, I don't think we should have had to have a lawsuit for Harvard to release a lot of this information and for us to find these big defects in its admissions process.
And Julie J. Park, you say in your book that you want to debunk the myth that Asian Americans are, in fact, discriminated against in selective college admissions. What leads you to that conclusion, and what evidence do you have?
Yeah, I think the holistic admissions process that is able to consider race of one of many, many, many factors serves Asian American students quite well. We know that Asian Americans make up high proportions of the student body at elite institutions. So at Harvard, you know, something like 22-23%, and similar at other Ivy Leagues and elite colleges. So they're clearly getting in. Holistic review, you know, not just admitting students because of their test scores and their GPAs, opens the door to all sorts of different Asian Americans, including those, you know, who weren't maybe the valedictorian, but have exceptional talents and exceptional skills in other areas. In terms of just evidence for discrimination, you know, if you're going on the statistics alone, Harvard's expert David Card, I think, did a pretty extensive job of showing that when you load all of these variables into the model, there wasn't evidence that Asian Americans were being discriminated against in the admissions process at Harvard. And that, you know, for whites, the numbers look higher on face value, but really that's because of some of the things that Aaron mentioned, which is mainly legacy and whites being a disproportionate presence of the recruited athletes and then legacies.
Dr. Julie Park is an associate professor of education at the University of Maryland. Aaron Mack covers tech and politics for Slate Magazine. And Brenda Shum is the director of Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're talking about affirmative action and college admissions. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to the phones. VJ in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. So, quick comment, then I'll take myself off. So you know, I'm an Indian American, former student. So I went to Duke University in the early 2000s. And what you know, and there are two sort of big things that I've found. One, you know, the experience of second-generation immigrants whose parents are from, let's say, China or India, to speak of two specific Asian countries, the focus on test scores is a very important focus in both those countries and continues to be one. Now, the American education system is slightly different in how colleges put emphasis on what is well-rounded. So in the household, sometimes among Asian American families, you may have a specific focus that may not be in line with really what colleges, particularly elite colleges, might be looking for. And that being said, you know, since I graduated in 2005, I've interviewed Duke students, Asian students, Black students, White students, and the reality is within each of those ethnicities, they're incredible students that are, you know, there's an incredible diversity of students that focus on test scores, students that focus on test scores plus other activities. I think there's two factors at play. One, that in fact they're incredibly well-rounded Asian students that are clearly getting into elite schools. But there's also a historical emphasis, if your parents come from an Asian country, on test scores, and that translates into how you spend your time in high school. So.
All right, well, thanks for that call, Vijay. I appreciate it. And Dr. Park, you say in your book there's no mystical Asian value around education, although there are an awful lot of people who think that there is.
Yeah, that's true, right? So Asian Americans are stereotyped as the model minority, and, you know, they're kind of put up on this, oh, everyone should be like that. But really, you know, they're very complex social factors, I think, as the caller brought in. And one of them is selective immigration policies, right, which preferenced highly educated immigrants from Asia to be able to come over, especially post-1965. And that's really the group that set the pace. And then you have other dynamics where, you know, for instance, in Asia, where admissions generally is based on a single test score, which is very different from the United States. So you have this group that is not a random representation of everyone over in Asia, right? They tend to, at least a portion of the group, tend to be from higher socioeconomic backgrounds. And then their understanding of how admissions work, right, is that it should be tilted more towards test scores. So I don't think it's, you know, should be any surprise that you have, you know, a lot of Asian American kids who do think that that's something that they should really focus on.
And Aaron Mack, Dr. Park writes in her book that, you know, these admissions committees have to evaluate, for example, maybe a low income candidate who didn't have time to play varsity sports or have all these extracurricular activities because she was working in a grocery store 25 hours a week and taking care of a sick relative. And others have said, why is the fight over race conscious admissions at all? It really should be about legacy admissions. So talk about the policy at Harvard, how it compares with some of the other Ivy League schools, and what you think the pernicious impact of legacy admissions is.
Sure. So legacy applicants are usually the privileged children of alumni and are admitted to the university at a rate five times that of non-legacies. More than 20% of white applicants admitted to Harvard were legacies, compared to 4.8% of Black students, 7% of Latino students, and 6.6% of Asian American students. So this is clearly a mechanism in their admissions process that is disadvantaging Asian Americans, Black Americans, Latino Americans, and it's sort of disturbing that Harvard has not put in a good faith effort to look at potentially phasing this out. It's kind of disturbing that a lot of progressive groups have not pushed Harvard to phase this policy out. I know that the Asian Americans Advancing Justice, National Coalition of Asian Pacific Americans don't have a position on legacy emissions, which is very concerning if we are people who are pushing for diversity on campuses.
And Brenda Shum, what's the legal implication of legacy admissions? I mean, Harvard and Cornell and Yale and Princeton are private institutions, right? I mean, they're nonprofits, so you can deduct any money you donate to them, but they can admit to their club whoever they want to admit, right? I mean, does the government, in terms of public policy and statute, have any say in the matter of allowing the kid of a very rich alumni into the school over that of a less advantaged applicant?
First, as a legal matter, I think it's important for people to understand that legacy admissions are not unconstitutional. However, I would also agree that this does not mean they are not problematic. As another data point, I think it's fairly significant to note that 30% of the admitted class at Harvard are special admits. They are one of the categories that has already been identified, and which are.
So, what does that mean? Special admits. What does that mean?
Special admits include the athletes, the legacies, the donors, children of faculty, et cetera.
Okay.
And we do know that those admittees, those special admittees, tend to be white. And you mentioned some of the other elite institutions that also have very strong legacy programs in place. And I think that we have to recognize that many of our public institutions and flagships have similar programs in place, and they are problematic from our perspective at the Lawyers Committee. I think that it's incumbent upon Harvard and other institutions to at least, at a minimum, take a very close look at the extent to which some of these structures may perpetuate disadvantage that really undermines any effort that they're making in other areas to have a more racially and ethnically diverse student population. And I do think it's also important to note that, and I know I'm emphasizing this over and over again, but we talked a little bit about the model minority myth, but there is another myth that the Harvard case really brings to light, and that is the myth that standardized test scores and high school grades are accurate indicators of merit, and more importantly, that they help institutions predict future academic success. And there is some pretty solid research out there that not only are standardized test scores and high school grades reflective of implicit bias and therefore not good indicators of how a student might have performed or can perform. But there's also very little evidence to show that relying on those allegedly objective measures of merit will actually allow institutions to predict who is successful once students arrive on campus.
And Dr. Park, what's your take on that? We got to take a break, but before we do, let me have you respond to that. What could be the proper metric to decide a young student's capacity and ability to succeed?
Yeah, I don't think there's any one single piece of information, right? Whether it's tests, scores, grades, extracurriculars, your essay, right? It should never be a single item. I would be fine with elite institutions going SAT, getting rid of the SAT. I know that a lot of them probably don't want to because, you know, they get an overwhelming number of applications, and it is one way that you can kind of divide students or sort them into layers. I would say, you know, if SAT is going to continue to be used, it needs to be looked at in context, right? So understanding that there are certain groups that are much more likely to get test prep and benefit from test prep. And so that would be more affluent students, and that would be Asian American students. And I don't think that should be applied in some sort of automatic way, like, oh, you're an Asian American, your test score means less. Like, I don't think that's what it necessarily means, but it's contextual, right? It's understanding that these test scores just don't come out of thin air, and they're not necessarily this objective, consistent, reliable measure of excellence.
Before we go on a break, just a couple of little factoids here. The median income of families of children who attend Harvard is $168,000 a year. 15% of the families of students at Harvard have annual income of more than $630,000 a year. The endowment at Harvard, $37.1 billion. That compares, for example, with Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore, where their endowment is $3.4 billion. So in terms of those two institutions and their capacities to offer financial aid and scholarships, that's a pretty steep difference. We will talk more about affirmative action and college admissions when we come back from a break. Brenda Shum is the director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Julie J. Park is an associate professor of education at the University of Maryland. Her latest book is called Race on Campus, Debunking Myths with Data. And Aaron Mack is with us as well. He covers tech and politics for Slate Magazine. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're discussing affirmative action and so-called racial balancing and the ways to achieve diversity on college campuses in light of a lawsuit brought against Harvard University by a group of Asian American students who were high achievers in high school and who didn't get into Harvard. The suit was brought by a group called Students for Fair Admissions, which is headed by a conservative former congressional candidate from Texas, who was also part of the 2013 Supreme Court decision that removed part of the Voting Rights Act. His name is Edward Blum. Harvard accepts fewer than 5% of the more than 40,000 students who apply. One internal study at Harvard that came out during the trial found that if only academic performance were factored into admission decisions, in other words, if that was the only factor that they thought about, academic performance, the Harvard student body would be more than 40% Asian. Nationally, 40% of all Asian American students in the United States attend community colleges. My guests are Dr. Julie J. Park of the University of Maryland. Her latest book is called Race on Campus, Debunking Myths with Data. Brenda Shum, she's the director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And Aaron Mack, he's written about the Harvard case for Slate Magazine. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. So, Brenda Shum, folks are saying that Mr. Blum, who's brought this lawsuit against Harvard, really doesn't care about Asian American students. What he cares about is getting rid of affirmative action in general, and that this case is creating a wedge, and it's purposely driving a wedge between communities of color. If you assume that Asian Americans are part of that community of color, and I want to talk about whether or not that's even the case or whether that's perceived to be the case. But do you think this is, in fact, putting a wedge between African Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanic students, et cetera?
Well, if nothing else, I would say that Ed Blum is very transparent about both his short-term goals for this litigation and his long-term goals for affirmative action and race-based policies in general. More importantly, I think that it is that this case was really designed to escalate racial anxiety and to divide communities of color in terms of their support for policies that have really been intended to contextualize and address some but not all of the systemic and structural racism that has plagued our country's education system. And I think that, you know, there have been a lot of good efforts to do some updated and additional polling and surveying of folks within the Asian American community. And I think that the specific voices, primarily, but not exclusively, primarily East Asian voices, have dominated and played an outsized role in terms of shaping the narrative, both around this case, but also around affirmative action more broadly. And those voices are not representative, representative of how Asians as a broader community feel about affirmative action. And if you think about just even that term, Asian Americans, it fails to recognize the rich diversity within that population group Southeast Asians. There are our student group, for example, the groups of students that we represented include a number of students of different Asian ethnicities. And one of the students who testified was a Vietnamese American, but we also had a student testify who is the daughter of Chinese immigrants. And she spoke very movingly and eloquently about how her family did not fit within the model minority myth. And she was cautioned by her high school guidance counselor not to include information about her race or ethnicity in her college application essays, because he told her that the Chinese immigrants story was overdone and would be viewed negatively by admissions officers. But she ignored that advice, and she did not speak just about her race. She really submitted an essay that talked about the role that she played as a translator and navigator for her Chinese immigrant parents, and how that impacted her life, but also her long-term life goals and career goals. And I think that you can tell from her admission file that Harvard was really struck by this and viewed it positively. And once again, I think that having access to that information really is direct evidence that counters SFFA's narrative that Asians are unilaterally viewed negatively and penalized when they reveal or discuss their ethnicity or their racial background in their college application.
Yeah, Washington Post had an interview with a young woman who's a sophomore at Harvard, African American, who said who wrote her college essay about being bullied in high school and how she reacted to that. And she said, of course, that experience was inextricable from my race. I was bullied because I was one of the few African American kids in her high school. So this was a very important dimension of her life, and it would be impossible for her to separate her race from her personal experience. I mean, Aaron Mack, I want to talk about something called the Z list, which came to light during the trial. Harvard keeps this list. We heard about dean's lists and these other special lists that indicated that applicants were sons or daughters of rich potential donors, that kind of thing. But the Z list, a lot of the information about that evidently was redacted. So Harvard is trying to keep this pretty close to the chest. What do you know about the Z list, and how does it differ from some of these other special admissions lists?
So Harvard refers to the Z list as deferred admissions. So these students get in 1 year, but they have to take a year off before they can actually enter the class. The Z list is, as you said, usually the children of very wealthy alumni or big donors. We know that the Z list is 70% white. And this is just one of those other mechanisms that really disadvantage people of color in the Harvard admission system. And it sort of elucidates their lack of transparency over their whole admission system, which I think is really damaging affirmative action.
Let's see if we can grab a phone call or two. Kristen in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in and give my perspective as a high school student, a high school senior who is coming in and is going through this whole admissions process. And on the whole trial, I just kind of wanted to say that I felt that the students who were filing this claim were a tad feeling entitled, because just looking at the numbers isn't enough. That's not a whole student. That's not all that a person is. Just because you got a 1300 and someone else got a 1550, there's different circumstances that have to go through with who they are as a person, and their admissions counselors have to take into consideration how they would be in the actual school. They don't want someone who's just going to be in their dorm setting all the time. That's not what they want for a college campus. So I just kind of felt that they felt entitled to be able to get in just because they got the scores. Like, there was some promise, if you get the score, you'll get in. And I don't think it's fair for a number just to be able to define what a student, if a student goes to college or not, because whether or not a student goes to college can change the path of their life. Because as we know, a person who goes to college has way more opportunities for jobs and employment. And also, if you don't go to college, you'll either end up going to a college of lower quality or end up getting a large amount of student debt.
Yeah.
So I just feel like it should be considered the other factors.
Right. Well, debt is certainly a big part of it as well. Well, thanks, Kristen. I appreciate it. And as we say in show business, break a leg on your college admissions applications. Julie Park, part of the concern that that a lot of academics have, certainly, and you voiced it in your book, is that people need to get over this obsession with getting into Harvard or getting into Yale or getting into Princeton, that there are lots and lots of really good schools out there, and that it's a broader problem of the perception that if you don't go to Harvard or you don't go to one of these Ivy Leagues, that your life is going to be ruined.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't go to Harvard, and my life is going pretty well. But yeah, unfortunately, I think within the Asian American a section of the Asian American community, there is this hyper focus on prestige, right? And so Harvard is seen as the ultimate golden ticket. But really, it's what you make of your college experience that matters so much more. I mean, you want to go to a decent college that has good academics, good extracurricular opportunities, good opportunities for whatever you want to major in. But beyond that, you know, it's not about the name brand. It's what a student really makes out of the experience. So yeah, I do want people to realize there are many, many more great places beyond Harvard, like the University of Maryland, College Park.
There you go. A little plug for your current employer. I want to talk about mismatching. There is a report New York Times wrote about a little bit ago from the National Bureau of Economic Research. These reports that they issue pretty frequently are not peer-reviewed. They are often preliminary reports. But there is one report that's called Affirmative Action and the Quality Fit Trade-Off. And they found that affirmative action policies in higher ed might actually contribute to worse educational and economic outcomes for students who are unprepared for the academic rigor of the selective colleges and law schools. Brenda Shum, what's your reaction to that potential contention?
So I am aware of the mismatch theory, and I'm also aware that there's been a good deal of research in social science that has been successful at debunking that theory. And I think that it really, unfortunately, perpetuates a lot of racial stereotypes, both about achievement and merit, but also about capacity. I think that I appreciate our high school callers' comments and questions, because I think that it's really essential to understand the college admission process and to realize that being academically exceptional does not distinguish you as an applicant if you're applying to an institution like Harvard. It is really essential to demonstrate that you are bringing a full set of potential capacity, talent, grit, a lot of different qualities that you intend to contribute to the Harvard classroom as well as the Harvard campus. And so it was really, I think, an important opportunity for our students who testified to really demonstrate that we had a Latinx student as well as an African American student testify. They both did exceptionally well in their high schools, were very academically qualified, and continued to do very well academically at Harvard.
Right.
And I think that, the data indicates that is certainly more the case than
Thank you, Brent. I'm afraid we're going to have to make that the last word. I appreciate all of you being with us this afternoon for a really good conversation. That's Brenda Shum. She is the director of the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. We've also been joined by Aaron Mack, who covers politics and tech for Slate Magazine, excuse me, and Julie J. Park. She's an assistant professor of education at the University of Maryland in College Park and the author of Race on Campus, Debunking Myths with Data. We also want to thank Morgan Ome for her great assistance in putting our program together today. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Mike Curley, a visiting scholar at the Environmental Law Institute, is going to talk about financial strategies to improve the environment. His new book is called Paying for Tomorrow, Maintaining Our Quality of Life. Plus, we're going to hear from theater critic J. Wynn Russick. She's going to review the premiere of Beetlejuice at the National Theater over in D.C., and Kara Ober is going to talk about the new issue of Be More Art. Lunch today provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden. They offer a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening, they're teaching folks how to make Spanish paella. And on Friday night, you can choose between vegetarian Indian cuisine and pasta ripiena. In other words, you can't go wrong. More on the web at BaltimoreChefShop.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.